We can keep that passage open as we come today to study Genesis chapter 32. We're thinking today about facing our fears and wrestling with God. Facing our fears and wrestling with God. When big moments come in life, we often talk about having to face things. People talk about having to face up to a problem. Maybe they've thought about, there's that idea of avoiding it for as long as you can. You put it off. You don't want to have to deal with it. But then the moment comes that you have to face it. People talk about facing the music, particularly perhaps if you've done something that you know you shouldn't have done and you've been trying to get away with it. Maybe you've got a bit of an attack of a guilty conscience, or you talk to someone about it and they say, look, you're just going to have to face the music. You're going to have to receive your punishment. Sometimes in the world of sport, they talk about a face-off, two opponents facing off, fighting perhaps in a boxing match for some title, whether it be a lightweight or heavyweight champion of the world, and they have to face off to get this title. When we use that language of facing, really, what we're getting at is that there is no avoiding it. Something just has to be reckoned with. Something perhaps that we've been putting off, something that perhaps we didn't want to have to face, now we do have to face it. It has to be dealt with. And this is where we are in the life of Jacob. Something has been hanging over Jacob for 20 years that he's always known that he's going to have to deal with, and he can put it off no longer. At God's command, he is returning to his homeland, the promised land of Canaan, knowing that what lies ahead of him is Esau, his estranged twin brother. Jacob has no idea what to expect, and neither do we. I always want you to try and put yourself into the story. I know some of you know the story very well. Boys and girls, you maybe already knew the story before we read it this morning, but try to put yourself in Jacob's shoes. 20 years that you haven't seen your brother. And the last time we heard Esau speak was in Genesis 27 and verse 41. And you remember what he said? These are the last words that Esau has spoken up until now. Genesis 27, 41. The days of mourning for my father are approaching. Then I will kill my brother Jacob. That's the last thing we heard Esau say. Isaac, my dad, will be dead soon enough, and then I'll kill Jacob. And the question is that still going to be Esau's attitude all these years later? What lies ahead for Jacob? The chapter is beautifully constructed in the original language. It's amazing, just the different words and words that sound like other words that are used all the way through this passage. One of the words that we keep seeing, and many of these words do come out in the English translation, but one of the words is the word camp. You notice the word camp used several times. Verse 2, the word Machanaim, which in Hebrew means two camps. And in the Hebrew there, the word for two camps, Machanaim, it sounds very like the word for present, which is the word Minha in Hebrew, Machanaim and Minha. And Jacob here is all concerned, as we'll think shortly, about a present, sending a present ahead of him to Esau. And then there's also the word crossing or deliverance. Jacob has to cross the Jabbok River, and indeed he sends his family over, and there's some debate as to whether he himself is on one side or the other of the Jabbok when the wrestling match takes place. And even those words, Jabbok and Jacob and wrestling in Hebrew, they all sound very similar as well. And so it's a very interesting in the way this passage has been constructed. But perhaps one of the most important words in the passage is that word face. Jacob is entirely preoccupied at first with seeing the face of Esau. Verse 20, look at verse 20. He thought to himself, I may appease him. I may appease Esau with the present, the minha that goes ahead of me. And afterward, I shall see his face. Perhaps he will accept me. And so Jacob is dreading having to see the face of Esau. And yet by the end of the passage, Jacob has become entirely preoccupied with the face of someone else, the face of his God. Before Jacob has to deal with Esau, before Jacob has to see the face of Esau again, he is going to have a transformative encounter before the face of God. Now, he won't see the face of God in all its glory. It'll be dark. But God nonetheless sees Jacob. And Jacob knows that he has come before the face of God, and he will be dramatically changed by that encounter before he enters into the promised land. God has dealings with Jacob before he crosses that border and faces Esau. So just two main points today. First of all, preparation for facing our biggest problem. Preparation for facing our problem. And then we'll think about transformation when we face our God. So first of all, preparation for facing our biggest problem. About two-thirds of the chapter is Jacob taken up with preparing to face Esau. How does he prepare to face this, his biggest problem? Or in some ways we might say, how does God prepare him to face him? Well, three ways just to note, and we'll deal with them very briefly, each one of them. But first of all, we see Jacob glimpsing God's protection. This is the first part of his preparation, that he glimpses God's protection. If you look at Genesis 32, verses 1 and 2, Jacob went on his way, and the angels of God met him. And when Jacob saw them, he said, "This is God's camp." So he called the name of that place Mahanaim, which means two camps. This is the second of three supernatural, we would say, or three miraculous encounters that Jacob has with God or with angels of God over the course of his life. The first of them, you remember, was when he was leaving the promised land and God met him at Bethel, and there was that stairway to heaven and angels walking up and down on it. That was when Jacob was on his way out of the promised land. And now God gives him another amazing sight, this time as he makes his way back into the promised land. We're not sure exactly what this looked like for Jacob to see this camp of angels, or what exactly he's referring to when he says two camps. Is he referring to his own human camp and then the angelic camp? Or was it perhaps the fact that there were angels either side of Jacob's camp, sort of flanking Jacob, and so there was a camp of angels on one side and a camp of angels on the other? We don't know. But the point is, friends, that this was a wonderfully encouraging sight for Jacob to see. He is fearful, as we'll see. He is wondering what lies ahead, but he gets this glimpse of God's protection. God prepares him for what lies ahead with this encouraging sight. And this is what God often does for us as we face big decisions or big problems, as we come to a crossroads in our lives, friends, in some way or other, often out of the blue and perhaps even in miraculous ways. God encourages his people. He reminds us of his protection. You think of Jesus' baptism we looked at a few months ago in Matthew chapter 3. That baptism, really, Jesus' ordination, if you like, for his ministry, a ministry that was going to be so difficult and demanding, and a death that was going to be so demanding. And before it all happens, Jesus is baptized, and the Father said at the baptism, "This is my Son, whom I love." And that was great encouragement from the Father to the Son. When you think of some of the encouragements that the early church received, they have this great mission to go out and preach the gospel to all the nations. And they begin to face persecution very early on in the life of the New Testament church. But even in the midst of that persecution and the challenges that they face, God gave encouragements. You think, for example, in Acts chapter 12, of Peter being set free from prison, being spared death by an angel coming and punching him on the arm and miraculously escorting him out of prison. And it's the same for us today, friends. God gives us little glimpses of his protection and encouragement as we prepare for challenges in life. Could be as simple as a text or a note from a friend, a gift for a pressing need, a timely sermon Oftentimes those who have gone off to plant a church, very difficult and demanding job for someone to go and plant a church, but very often in the earliest days of the church, of a church being planted, God gives encouragements. People come along, people show an interest, there's a bit of a core group gathers together. Ralph Davis says this seems to be the pattern in God's ways, providing fresh support in face of a coming need. So here's how God begins to prepare Jacob. He gives him a glimpse of God's protection. But then we also, and somewhat more negatively perhaps, depending on how you interpret it, but we see Jacob here also in his preparation, nervously making plans. Nervously making plans. Verse 3, Jacob sent messengers before him to Esau, his brother, in the land of Seir, the country of Edom, instructing them, "Thus you shall say to my lord Esau, thus says your servant Jacob, I have sojourned with Laban and stayed until now. I have oxen and donkeys and flocks and so on. I have sent to tell my lord in order that I may find favor in your sight." Now, Jacob is not showing off here. He's not saying, "Oh, look, Esau, I'm back after 20 years and look at all the swag I have. How have you been doing in the 20 years?" That's not what's going on. What he's actually doing is he's very humbly coming before Esau, and he's saying, "Look, Esau, I'm not coming as a threat in any way. I'm not coming to take your land or take your stuff or take your animals. I have my own animals. I believe I have my own inheritance to come to." Notice as well that he says that his servants are to call Esau Lord. And Jacob is described, he describes himself as Esau's servant. And a couple of times that's repeated to us. Jacob is emphasizing here to Esau that he doesn't bear him any ill will. And in some ways you might say that he's almost, you might say that he's temporarily suspending his claim to the blessing, the family blessing. Remember, this was such a bone of contention between them. And there was that prophecy that Rebekah had received, the older son shall serve the younger. One commentator actually says that Jacob here, he's trying to return the blessing or the birthright to Esau. I wouldn't go that far, but I would certainly say he's going out of his way to show him respect and humility. He's saying, "Look, you can take all of this if you want, but I am certainly not coming as a threat. I am coming as your servant." But then Jacob's first batch of messengers come back and they bring news that chills Jacob to his bones. Verse 6, Esau is coming to meet you, and there are 400 men with him. 400 well-wishers for me, 400 people who are going to come and sing lovely songs about reconciliation while Esau and I give each other a big hug, or 400 soldiers who are coming to wipe me out. Which is it? And so Jacob gets in a bit of a panic. And he divides up his house, this whole idea of the camp again. He divides his household into two camps, verses 7 and 8. And then in verses 13 to 21, even after Jacob has spent time in prayer, which we'll think about in a moment, he feels the need to send even more in the way of a gift to Esau. He sends him close to 600 animals, drove after drove after drove. And he's hoping that as each drove meets Esau, that perhaps the frown on Esau's face will piece by piece and drove by drove turn into a big smile, and that Esau will be so pacified and impressed that any ill will that he bears to Jacob will disappear. Notice verse 20. I may appease him with the present that goes ahead of me, and afterward I shall see his face. Perhaps he will accept me. Now, it's very hard to know what to make of Jacob and all these nervous plans that he made. Did he need to do this? Well, Genesis chapter 33, which God willing will come to next week, would suggest that he didn't need to do this. We'll see that next week, God willing. The commentators are quite split on this, which isn't helpful for the preacher. But Calvin, for those of you who would perhaps take his opinion over most of the rest of them anyway, Calvin suggests that this was just good sense on Jacob's part, that he was being prudent, that he was showing respect. It's hard to know. We're not told exactly whether this was necessary or whether this was just wise, calm planning on Jacob's part, or whether it was nervous planning on Jacob's part. But we know from chapter 33 that it wasn't necessary, that God had graciously smoothed the way and calmed down Esau's heart. Esau, in fact, wanted to be reconciled, as we'll see next week. But at least we can say here that Jacob also wants to be reconciled. He wants to see the face of his brother. He wants things to be put right. But better than the practical plans that he made here was the preparation Jacob took by seeking God in prayer. Seeking God in prayer. So he glimpsed God's protection. He was nervously making plans, but he was also seeking God in prayer. Notice that Jacob's prayer comes right in the middle of this section about his preparation. And so it's the most important part. His prayer demonstrates that while he still has a long way to go, he's not a perfect man yet, Jacob nonetheless has been changing and growing in his faith and knowledge of God. Look at verse 9. Jacob said, O God of my father Abraham and God of my father Isaac, O Lord, Yahweh, the covenant name of God, O Yahweh who said to me. Jacob knows his God. In calling God by his name here, by his covenant name, by mentioning his father and his grandfather, Jacob shows that he has personally come to know and to trust this God. And notice that as well, the humility and the gratitude of his prayer. He says, I am not worthy of the least of all the deeds of steadfast love. He says, with only my staff I crossed this Jordan, and now I have become two camps. There's something here that Jacob really needs, something that he really wants. But notice, friends, he still takes time to humbly give thanks for all that he already has. And then he makes his plea in verse 11. Please deliver me from the hand of my brother, from the hand of Esau, for I fear him, that he may come and attack me, the mothers and the children. He's not just thinking of himself, he's thinking about his whole household. And this was the best preparation that Jacob could have made. Far better than all those animals being sent ahead of him was the time that he spent in prayer. And Calvin suggests that God prompted Jacob to pray, that he put him in circumstances that led him to pray by his knowledge of the fact that these 400 men were coming to meet him with Esau, by the fact that he was nervously wondering, what will my brother think after 20 years? That led Jacob, in the providence of God, to the place of prayer. What part, friends, does prayer play when we feel like we're facing our biggest problems? What part does prayer play in proportion to plans, or proportion to worry, or proportion to fretting, when you and I face difficulties or discouragements? What part does reflecting on God's encouragements and his protection play as we face up to our biggest problems? Whether it's the challenges of our parenting, whether it's the challenges of our church, our desire for people to join us here for worship, our desire for fellowship, and our desire to see the church built up here in Dromore. What part does prayer play in that, either individually or corporately? Some of us are anxious or fearful about things today, but we're not prayerful about them. Some of us are great planners, but we're not great prayers. The Lord Jesus was anxious and fearful, even at times to the point of sweating blood, as he prepared to face the cross and face the wrath of his Father. He prayed, and an angel from heaven strengthened him. Ralph Davis says, do we name our fears as honestly and truthfully as Jacob did here? They might not be big fears or worries in the world's eyes. Maybe that's what stops us from praying about them sometimes. We think, oh, God's not going to want to hear about the worry I have about my family or my children or my neighbor or my health. God's a big God. He's more to worry about than me. No, friends. Jacob says here, I fear my brother Esau. Please deliver me. As simply as that, as boldly as that, do you pray like that? Do you name your fears and worries to the Lord? However trivial others might think them to be, however much you might think, well, maybe I should be able to deal with this myself by now. No, bring them to the Lord in prayer. One commentator, Ian Duguid, says, you lay out all your fears before the Lord. Ask him to do what he has committed himself to do in his word. Then press on in faith. Name your fears, then press on in faith. I was touched by the story of Beth and Lloyd Jones, the wife of the great preacher Martin Lloyd Jones. They lived for a season of life in Wales. They were living actually on the coastline. And Beth and Lloyd Jones's wife would worry in those early days about if a storm brewed up strong enough, would the tide just come all the way in and just batter their little house to bits? And she had a little infant child at the time. And one night her husband was off engaged in church work somewhere. The storm was whipping up all around the house. The windows and the doors were knocking and banging in the wind. And she just prayed and said, Lord, if you are all that you are, and if you have done all that you can do, you can stop this storm and take away my fear. Please help. And she said there was complete silence in the house the rest of the night. Because God cares about mothers home alone with their children on a dark, stormy night. God cares about the thing that is the biggest problem, the biggest cause of fear in your life today, even if it might seem trivial and unimportant to everybody else. So lay out all your fears to the Lord, commit them to him, and press on in faith. So preparation for facing our biggest problem. But secondly and finally today, transformation when we face our God. Transformation when we face our gracious God. Look at verses 22 to 24. The same night he arose and took his two wives, his two female servants, and his 11 children, and crossed the ford of the Jabbok. He took them and sent them across the stream and everything else that he had, and Jacob was left alone. And a man wrestled with him until the breaking of the day. What? Okay, so he's packing up his house. He's moving this convoy of children and camels and gear and everything else. He stops in the middle of the night to take a breather and get his bearings and hopefully try and get a good night's sleep despite all the fear and worry that he has. And someone wrestles him all night long. What a shocking thing to read in this story. Again, if we perhaps hadn't heard the story many, many times before, Jacob is assailed. Jacob is physically assaulted all night long. Now, there's a degree of mystery, of course, to this whole encounter. It's dark, for one thing. He can't really see what's going on. But it's not just a vision or a dream. This is physical. Jacob, as we'll see, bears the scars of this encounter for the rest of his life. Perhaps most surprising of all is the fact that though it is, quote, a man who wrestles with Jacob, by the end of the wrestling match, Jacob is in no doubt that he has wrestled with God. Verse 29, Jacob asks his assailant for his name, and the reply is, why do you ask my name? In other words, you don't need to. You know who I am. There's also a sense here of we don't overuse the name of God out of reverence and out of fear that it be blasphemed or misused. This is God who encounters Jacob and assaults Jacob and wrestles with Jacob. Look at verse 30. I have seen God face to face, and yet my life has been delivered. God came and wrestled with Jacob. Jacob spent the night grappling, tackling, panting, pushing, striving, kicking up the dust, gasping for breath, scraping his knees, trying to get a foothold, jabbing his fists against God himself. Boys and girls, maybe you do some wrestling from time to time. And maybe in particular it's the boys who might do this, but maybe the girls do it as well. You have a good old scrap the odd time, maybe just for fun. It's okay if it's just for fun. supervised perhaps by parents nearby. But when you wrestle, when you get really close and tight to your opponent and you're pushing and shoving and trying to get on top of them and they're trying to get on top of you, you're exhausted very quickly, aren't you? You have to stop for breath. This wrestling match goes on all through the night. And this person that Jacob wrestled with is almost certainly the angel of the Lord that we see mentioned several times in the Old Testament. Pre-incarnate God the Son, perhaps, who met with Abraham in Genesis 18, who called Gideon into service in Judges chapter 6, who spoke to Samson's parents in Judges 13. They also said to the angel of the Lord, "What is your name?" And he said, "Why do you ask me my name?" Judges 13, 18, seeing that it is wonderful. And this is why, by the way, the man tells Jacob to let him go right before the dawn, verse 26. It's not because the man is beaten or tired. It's so that Jacob doesn't see the face of God in all its glory. Friends, Jacob has an encounter with the living God. And God chooses to wrestle with him. And God chooses to exhaust him. And God chooses to permanently wound him. And yet God also blesses him. Why? What is this all about? Well, I'll suggest a couple of words that might sum it up. First of all, identity. Identity. Verse 26, the man says to Jacob, "Let me go, for the day has broken." But Jacob said, "I will not let you go unless you bless me." And he said to him, you can't bless someone without knowing their name. He said to him, "What is your name? What is your name?" And he said, "Jacob." And in confronting Jacob in this very physical way and demanding that Jacob speak his own name, God is getting Jacob to confront who he is. Trickster, schemer, deceiver. You remember Jacob's name means he grasps at the heel. And yet here is the cheater asking for the blessing. He's always wanted the blessing. He wanted it so much from his father Isaac that in Genesis 27, he pretended to be someone else. He covered himself in his brother's clothes. And when blind old Isaac was pronouncing the blessing and he said, "Who are you?" He said, "Esau." He lied to get that blessing. And now here he is asking for the blessing again. And he has nowhere to hide. He cannot lie. He says, "I am Jacob." But God gives him a new identity. And it's not, I don't believe that this is Jacob coming to faith. I think there's enough evidence that he already had faith. But it's an incident nonetheless that has a transformative impact on his life and his faith. Look at verse 28. He said, "Your name shall no longer be called Jacob, but Israel, for you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed." What a fascinating verse. First time in the Bible that the name Israel appears. Now, strictly speaking, friends, the name Israel, if you literally translate it, it means God fights. But names in the Bible are not always about the literal meaning. Sometimes when someone is named or renamed in the Bible, it's more about the circumstances of that renaming or the plans that God has for that person. And so look at the reason that he gives here for renaming him Israel. He says, "You have striven with God and with men and have prevailed." He's called Israel because he wrestles with God and he wrestles with men. He fights for the blessing and he prevails. As I say, this is the first use of the name Israel in the whole Bible. It's the name of the nation that would come from Jacob. And it's the name today of the church, the true church of Jesus Christ, Israel. It's a wonderful way of God saying, whoever you were before, you can have a new identity when you face me. When you come to me and receive blessing from me, a God of grace, a God who blesses despite who and what we are, tricksters, deceivers, sinners. Identity. But then this encounter is also about victory and yet humility. victory and yet humility. Boys and girls, maybe your parents have told you if you compete in sport that there's a good way to win and there's a bad way to win. You don't want to be winning and rubbing your opponent's face in it. You don't want to be winning. You don't want to get the victory only to become proud and arrogant. Jacob here gets the victory, but the victory is graciously handed to him, and it's handed to him in such a way that he is kept humble. He's not a proud victor. Look what happens, verse 25. When the man saw that he did not prevail against Jacob, he touched his hip socket, and Jacob's hip was put out of joint as he wrestled with him. Now, the miraculous thing is that Jacob clings on despite that. He receives the blessing in a sense, but in a sense, he's given the victory. But he's never the same again. God blesses him, but God wounds him. God leaves a mark in Jacob that would never disappear. I remember in a previous sermon I was preparing for, and different passage altogether, but I remember a line from one of the commentators: those whom God uses, he often first bruises. Those whom God uses, he often first bruises. God blesses Jacob here, but he bruises him as well. He wounds him. God leaves a mark that will never disappear. And of course, in doing so, the message is clear. God could have ended this wrestling match in an instant. God could have smacked down Jacob in a second, so much so that he could never have risen up again. But instead of crushing Jacob, God graciously blesses Jacob and yet wounds Jacob. Friends, please see this, though. It's a kind wound. It's a gracious wound. It's a wound that forever humbled Jacob. Notice verse 30. Jacob called the name of the place Peniel, saying, "For I have seen God face to face, and yet my life has been delivered." And I love verse 31. The sun rose upon him as he passed Penuel, limping because of his hip. The sun rises. It's a new day. It's a new day in every possible sense for Jacob, for Israel. He's seen the face of God, but to keep him humble, to remind him of how dependent he is on God's grace, as himself being a cheater and a deceiver, he is limping for the rest of his life. He's realized that far more important than facing his brother Esau, facing his biggest problem, is facing his God and yet receiving God's blessing. And that's really the point of the passage, friends, that what we should be most concerned with in life is not how we face other people, but how we face our God. What is it that you're wrestling with today that seems more important than anything else? For many people, it is identity. Discovering who we are, being our best selves, getting ourselves out there in the world and making our way and making our fortune and making our name. Maybe like Jacob, you've been trying to ignore who you are. You've cheated, you've run away from a problem, you've treated other people poorly to serve your own ambition. You've just been living for yourself. Or maybe for you today, the issue is assurance. You've an identity crisis. I don't know who I am. I don't know why I'm here. I don't know if there's any purpose to my life. Is God confronting you today in his word? Is he forcing you to confront who you really are? A Jacob, a sinner, a deceiver. And yet is he saying to you, "I will give you the blessing if you come and deal with me. I've provided Christ for you if only you trust in him and follow him." Or maybe you're a Christian here today, frustrated over some apparent weakness or challenge in your life. You know the Lord. You love the Lord. You've been busy pouring yourself out serving the Lord, yet he's making you walk with a limp, so to speak. He forces you each day to remember, as Jacob would have to do, of your frailty and your mortality and your weaknesses. Maybe this is in the realm of parenting. Maybe this is in the realm of some challenge in your work life. Maybe this is a growing awareness of your own sins that you need to conquer and deal with. Maybe as you sit here today, the weeks ahead, the days ahead, loom large with problems for you to face, whether it be illness or old age or loneliness or anything else. But hear what God told Jacob and hear what he says to you today. You are Israel because you have striven with God and with men and have prevailed. You are his chosen one. You are loved by him. You are blessed by him. Cling on to him. Ralph Davis says, you'll never fear an Esau if you've already wrestled with God. You'll never fear an Esau if you've already wrestled with God. You'll walk back into your home, your office, back down the street tomorrow, back toward your place of devotion and prayer as a conqueror, as a victor, and yet a humble victor, knowing afresh your dependency upon the grace of God to help you in your times of need. You remember Revelation is addressed to those seven churches, and to every church Jesus said, to the one who conquers, to the one who overcomes, there is blessing. To the one who overcomes, he will not be hurt by the second death. To the one who overcomes, I will give authority over the nations. He will rule them with a rod of iron. To the one who overcomes, I will grant to eat of the tree of life. We are overcomers, friends. We are those who cling on to God for the blessing and go to him each day in prayer, asking for fresh grace and asking for fresh help in our time of need. Are you doing that? Are you tempted to give up doing that? Come to him today. Cling on and receive the blessings that he has for you in Jesus Christ. In Jesus Christ, you know that he's never going to turn you away because Jesus is the one from whom he turned away. Jesus is the one who had to cling on and who was not only left limping, but who was crucified, stricken and smitten and pierced, cursed so that we could be blessed. So that we by faith could declare again today to God, whatever our problems may be, I will not let you go unless you bless me. Amen.